Quinn orders Harper to stay with his men, then leads me through the crumbling house built into the mountain and into a series of caverns. It's no wonder Karras hasn't found the old man. These tunnels are so extensive it would take months to explore all of them.
I expected you weeks ago, Quinn says as we walk. Why haven't you assassinated Karras yet?
She's not an easy woman to kill, General, I say, especially when Marcus can't afford for it to look like an assassination. We trek upward until we emerge onto a small, flat plateau, walled in on four sides but open to the sky. It is home to a hidden garden, wild with the beauty of a place once lovingly cared for, but left alone for too long. I have something for you. I pull Elias's mask from my pocket. Elias gave it to me before he left Blackcliff. I thought you'd want it. Quinn's hand hovers over the mask before he takes it.
It was a nightmare to get that boy to keep it on, he says. I thought he would lose the damn thing one day.
The old man turns the mask over in his hand, and the metal ripples like water.
They become part of us, you know. It is only when they join with us that we become our truest selves. My father used to say that after the joining, a mask held a soldier's identity, and that without it, a bit of his soul was stripped away, never to be recovered.
And what do you say, General?
We are what we put into the mask. Elias put little into it, and so it offered little in return.
I expect him to ask me about his grandson, but he simply pockets the mask.
Tell me of your foe, Bloodshrike.
As I relate the attack on Navium, the loss of the fleet, even the presence of the statue, Quinn is silent. We walk to a pond in the garden, bordered by paint-chipped stones. She's up to something, General, I say. I need your help to figure out what it could be, to figure her out.
Karras learned to walk here, before I moved her and her mother to Sarah.
He nods to a barely visible path that leads to a pergola dripping with ivy.
She was 9 months old. Tiny little thing. Skies, Corinna was so proud. She loved that girl to bits.
He raises his eyebrows at the look on my face.
You thought my dear late wife was the monster from whom Karras learned? Quite the opposite. Corinna wouldn't let anyone touch a hair on that girl's head. We had dozens of slaves, but Corinna insisted on doing everything herself, feeding her, changing her, playing with her. They adored each other.
The idea of a sunny-haired baby Karras is so far from what she is now that I can't conjure the image. I force myself to hold back the dozens of questions in my head. Quinn's voice is slow, almost halting, and I wonder if he's spoken to anyone about this.
I wasn't there for them early on, he says. I was already a lieutenant general when Corinna and I married. The Karkans were pushing hard in the west, and the Emperor couldn't spare me.
He sounds not sad, but almost wistful.
And then Corinna died. The Emperor didn't give me leave, so it was a year before I returned home. By then, Karras had stopped speaking. I spent a month with her, and then it was back to the battlefield. When she was chosen for Blackcliff, I was certain she'd die in the first week. She was so soft, so much like her mother.
But she didn't die, I say. I try not to tap my foot in impatience. I wonder when he's going to get to the point.
She's a Veturia, Quinn says. We're hard to kill. Skies know what she dealt with at Blackcliff. She didn't have your luck in friends, girl. Her fellow students made her life hell. I tried to train her, like I trained Elias, but she wanted nothing to do with me. Blackcliff warped her. Just after she graduated, she allied with the Nightbringer. He's the closest thing she has to a friend.
He's not her friend. He's her master, I murmur, remembering the djinn's words. What of Elias's father?
Whoever he was, she cared for him.
We are past the pond now, beyond the edge of the plateau. Low rolling hills ease into the flats of the tribal desert, blue with the approach of dawn.
After Elias was chosen, she was unnerved, worried she would lose her commission. I'd never seen emotion like that in her before then, or since. She said she let the child live, because his father would have wanted it.
So Karis loved Arius Harper. His file was scant, but the Commandant always hated Elias so much, I assumed his father had forced himself on her. Did you know Arius Harper, General?
He was a plebeian.
Quinn gives me a curious look, mystified by the sudden change in topic.
A combat centurion at Blackcliff, who was reprimanded repeatedly for showing mercy to the students. Kindness, even.
How did he die?
He was murdered by a group of masks the day after they graduated. Karis's fellow senior skulls. A vicious killing. More than a dozen of them beat him to death. Illustrian, all of them. Their fathers covered it up well enough that even I didn't know of it when it first happened.
Why would a group of masks murder a centurion? Did Karis know? Did she ask them to do it? But Quinn said she didn't have allies at Blackcliff, that the other students tormented her. And if she didn't have Arius killed, if she truly loved him, then why does she hate Elias so much?
You think Arius Harper is the father?
Quinn catches on.
So Captain Harper is...
Elias's half-brother. I curse under my breath. But none of that matters. Her past, her history, none of it explains what she's doing in Navium, I say. She gave up the fleet just to wrest power from me. Why?
My grandson always told me you were smart, girl.
Quinn scowls at me.
Was he wrong? Don't just look at her actions. Look at her. What does she want? Why? Look at her past, her history. How has it altered her mind? The Nightbringer is her master, you say. What does he want? Will she get it for him? What could she be doing for the Paters that they would agree to let that swine Grimmar wreak havoc in the poor parts of the city? Use that head of yours. If you think my daughter cares about the fate of a port city far from the seat of power, you are sorely mistaken.
But she's been ordered to.
Karis doesn't care about orders. She cares about one thing. Power. You love the Empire, Bloodshrike. So you believe that, because Karis was also raised as a mask, she must be loyal to it too. She is not. She is loyal only to herself. Understand that, and perhaps you'll best her. Fail. And she'll have your guts for supper before the week is out.
Chapter 20. Liar. The moment the sky pales, I throw on my dress and slip downstairs. If I move swiftly enough, I might still catch the tribal caravan I saw last night, and the Kehani too. But Zella awaits me at the door, fidgeting in apology. Musa asked that you remain here, she says. For your own safety, Liar. Princess Nikla has Jarduna patrolling the city for you. Apparently one of them caught wind that you were here last night. She wrings her hands. He says not to use your magic, as you'll just lead the Jarduna here, and get us all thrown in prison. His words, she adds quickly, not mine. What do you know about him, Zella? I ask quickly before she walks away. What is he doing out there? Why hasn't he started the resistance himself? I'm just a smith, Liar, and an old family friend of his. If you have questions, you'll have to ask him. I curse and slink out to the courtyard, where I assist Darin as he polishes a stack of sims against a set of smooth grey stones. I heard him, Darin, I say after relating my run-in with the Nightbringer, gloating right beside me. Then he was gone, which means he could be anywhere. He might even have the last piece of the star. I want so much to conquer the self-doubt rising in me, to quash it and simply believe that I can stop the djinn. Fear does not rule me as it once did. But some days it stalks me with the ire of a jilted lover. My brother slides a sim across one of the stones.
If the Nightbringer did have the last piece of the star, he says, we'd know.
You give him too much credit, liar, and you don't give yourself enough.
He fears you. He fears what you'll learn, what you'll do with that knowledge.
He shouldn't fear me.
He damned well should.
Darin runs a cloth across the sim he's polished and hands it to me before reaching for his first Serek steel blade, the one I carried across the Empire after Spiro Tillamon gave it to me. It makes no sense for him to be afraid, I say. I gave him the armlet. I let him kill Shaver. Why the hell should he be afraid of me? My voice rises, and on the other side of the courtyard, Tore and Zella exchange a glance before making themselves scarce.
Because you can stop him. And he knows it.
Darin tightens the brace he has fashioned for his left hand. He uses it in place of his two missing fingers to steady his hammers. And I almost never see him without it. This time, he clips in his sim hilt instead of a hammer.
Why else would he kill Shaver? Or ally himself with the Commandant? Why ensure the waiting place is in disarray? Why sow so much chaos if he's not afraid of failing? And,
Darin pulls me up.
Why else would he turn up the very moment you realized you might get answers from the Kahani?
That fact escaped me, and it makes me even more eager to speak to the tribeswoman. When the skies is Musa going to be back?
Spiro would kill me if he saw how little artistry that has.
Darin nods to my blade.
But if they're true Serek steel, we can celebrate that at least. Come on, maybe this is the batch that won't break.
Sparks fly as Darin's sim and mine crash against each other. The last set of blades we tried didn't break until well into our battle, so I settle in for an arduous contest. After a few minutes, the rough simplicity of the blade has raised blisters on my palms. It is so different from the fine dagger Elias gave me. But it holds. Zella and Tore emerge from the house, watching with growing excitement when, even after I press the attack, the blades remain whole. Darin assails me, and I let my ferocity loose, pouring my frustration into every blow. Finally, my brother calls a halt, unable to suppress a grin. He takes the blade from me.
It has no heart,
he hefts it, and his eyes sparkle as they haven't in months.
No soul. But it will do. On to the next.
Zella and Tore join us as we spar across the courtyard, as one after the other, the blades finally hold true. I do not notice Musa until he steps from the house to applaud jauntily.
Beautiful, he says. I had full faith. That you...
I grab Musa by the arm and drag him toward the front door, ignoring his curses of protest. I need to see a Kahani, and I've been waiting hours for you to return.
The tribes left Adisa to fight the marshals in the desert, Musa says. They're not holding back either.
With a chill, I remember Afia speaking of the attacks on marshal villagers. Well, they can't be far outside the city, I say. I just saw a Kahani telling stories near Adisa's main market. Silver hair, purple and white wagons.
Tribe salute, Musa says. I know the Kahani you speak of. She won't just tell you what you want to know, liar. She'll want payment.
Fine, we'll pay her, whatever she wants.
It's not that simple. Musa pulls his arm from my grip. She is not a street hawker selling cheap trinkets. She tells stories on her terms. Traditional gifts for such exchanges are items we don't have access to. Bolts of silk, chests of gold, stores of food. I examine him up and down, from the silver buckled boots to the soft leather breeches to the shirt made of finely spun cotton.
Don't tell me you're not wealthy. Turay said your father used to harvest half the honey in Marin.
I have some clothes, a bit of gold, he says. But the mariners seized my wealth and my property and my hives and inheritance when, he shakes his head. Anyway, they took it, and now my means are limited.
Zella and Turay exchange a glance at that, and I remind myself to find them later. I need answers about Musa's past, and it's clear he won't give them to me. My brother still clutches one of the new Sims. Sunlight glances off the blade, hitting me in the face. I know what's to offer her, I say. Something she'll want. Something she can't refuse.
Musa follows my gaze to the Serik steel blade.
I expect him to tell me the scholars need the blades more, or that we don't have enough. Instead, he raises his eyebrows.
You know what the tribes are doing in the south, he says. They're showing no mercy to any marshal, whether soldier or civilian.
I flush. Do you have information for me on the Nightbringer? Musa, of course, shakes his head. Then this is the best chance we have to learn something. If Darin agrees to part with the blades, of course.
Darin offers a resigned sigh. You need to stop the Nightbringer, he says. You need information to do it. I'm certain she'll take the blades. But liar,
I cross my arms, waiting for his criticism.
Mother made exchanges like this, he says. Exchanges that she perhaps didn't want to make. She did it for the good of her people. It's why she was the lioness, why she was able to lead the resistance. But in the end, it added up. It cost her, and it cost us.
Mother did what she had to, I say. It was for us, Darin, even if it didn't feel like it. Skies, I wish I had half her courage, half her strength. I'm not. This isn't easy. I don't want innocence hurt, but I need something on the Nightbringer. I think Mother would agree.
You don't,
something flickers in Darin's face. Pain, perhaps, or anger, emotions he tries to keep as deeply buried as a mask would.
You have your own strength, he finally says. It doesn't have to be the same as the lioness's.
Well, this time it does. I harden myself, because if I don't, then I'm back to figuring out what the hells I can take the Kahani when what I should be doing is getting to her as fast as possible. Beside me, Musa shakes his head, and I turn on him, temper rising. You wanted me to be a resistance leader, I say. Here's a lesson I learned from the last resistance fighter I knew. To lead, you have to do ugly things. We leave in an hour. Come along or stay, it doesn't matter to me. I do not wait for Musa's answer as I walk away, but I feel his surprise. And Darin's. I feel their disappointment, and I wish it did not bother me so much.
Chapter 21. Elias. The screams echoing from the tribal encampment are distinctly human, and they grow louder by the moment. I sprint toward them, Abarit and Afia following, the latter demanding that I explain what's happening. Get to shelter! I cut off the Zaldara's tirade. I'll answer your questions later. Just hide! Dozens of people flee the Noor caravan, and as I approach it, I draw my Sims. The closest screams come from a bright green wagon covered in mirrors. I know it well. It belongs to Afia's little brother, Gibran. The back of the wagon bursts open, and the handsome young tribesman emerges. He grabs a man from within the wagon and tosses him like a rag doll.
Uncle Tosh!
Afia gasps and runs past me, toward her brother.
Chip, no!
Her brother turns to look at her, and the tribeswoman slowly backs away, her face frozen in terror. Gibran's eyes are pure white. He's possessed. The escaped ghost has taken over his body. Because I didn't pass them through fast enough, because there are too many, and they have no place to go but back into the world of the living. Gibran lunges for Afia. Though she is a dozen feet away, he reaches her in one leap and lifts her up by her throat. The small woman kicks out at him, her face purpling. Before I can get to him, Gibran throws her too. My mask's instinct kicks in, and I drop into a stalking crouch. If I can knock the tribesman unconscious, perhaps something in Arborit's mysteries will tell me how to exorcise the ghost. But a ghost-possessed tribesman is no ordinary foe. The way he threw Afia makes it clear that the spirit within him has physical powers far beyond what Gibran himself possesses. My skin prickles. He's seen me. I duck behind a wagon. He knows I'm coming, but I don't have to make it easy for him. In the distance, a group of men and women snatch up children and race for the river, Arborette screaming at them to move faster. I scan the riverbank for Afia, but she has disappeared. When I turn back to Gibran, he's gone.
Idiot, Elias. Never turn your back on a foe.
I sheathe my sims. I don't want to hurt him.
Too late. I hear a whoosh in the air. Attack! Gibran is on my back, and I lurch to my knees beneath his unnatural weight. His arm, thin but muscled from months of battling marshals, comes around my throat, and he has the strength of five men. He babbles in my ear, his voice a fey growl.
They raised it, burned it, corn, silk, and blood, and flour.
I know I can die as Soulcatcher, but by the skies, I won't die by the hand of a ghost-possessed tribesman choking the life out of me while gibbering in my ear. I claw at Gibran's arm, unnerved by his strength. Suddenly, a metallic thunk reverberates, and his hold loosens. Gasping and grabbing my throat, I back away from him to see Afia holding a cast-iron pan. She retreats from Gibran, who, though momentarily weakened, is getting to his feet.
Run!
I bellow at Afia, leaping upon Gibran's back.
To the river! Run!
She whirls as Gibran goes down. He's impossible to keep in one place. I land a blow on his head. A second, a third. Skies, I'm going to have to kill him if I want the ghost out of him. I can't kill him. He's just a boy. He doesn't deserve this.
Damn you!
It is half snarl, half cry. Gibran makes Afia laugh like no one else. He loves with his whole heart, his family and his friends and his many lovers. And he's young, too young for such a horrific fate.
Get out of him!
I bellow.
Get out! Get!
On my fifth blow, Gibran finally loses consciousness. The ghost oozes out of him, slumped, as if exhausted, and disappears, back to the waiting place, I hope.
Gib!
Afia returns from where she's retreated, dropping the pan.
Did it kill him? What the hell's happened? Where did that thing come from?
It escaped the waiting place.
If Gibran dies, it will be me who killed him by failing to pass the ghosts on.
Don't die, Gibran. Please don't die.
Are there others?
Afia shakes her head, but I can't be sure until I check the whole camp myself. I'm certain I saw more than one ghost escape.
How did they escape?
Afia asks.
What happened?
I failed.
I look into my friend's eyes. I make myself do it, because it's true and she deserves to know. I think she will be angry, but she just grabs my shoulder and squeezes. I have to figure out if there are any more. I shake her off. Her understanding is a gift I don't deserve. Keep everyone near the river, inside it if they're able. Ghosts hate water.
Help me get him up,
Afia says, and when I've slung Gibran's arm around her neck, she drags him away. But she has only gone a few dozen yards when she freezes. Her body goes stiff, like a bowstring yanked taut, then slack as wet dough. Gibran falls to the ground, and she takes a deep, wolf-like sniff of the air. She turns toward me, eyes white as snow.
No.
Afia moves at me with impossible speed. The contrast between the familiarity of her face and form and the violence of her actions raises a chill along my spine. She has her frying pan in her hand, and I know that if she hits me with that thing, soul catcher or not, I'm going to have one hell of a headache. She swings it at me clumsily, and I catch her wrist, squeezing hard enough to make a normal woman drop the pan. But she only growls at me, a guttural moan that chills my blood.
Think, Elias, think. Battle can't have been the only thing you learned at Blackcliff.
A little girl, hiding until now, rushes past us, trying to escape. Like an animal sensing weaker prey, Afia rips away from me and bounds after the girl. The child pumps her small legs, but she isn't fast enough. When Afia leaps upon her, the girl's neck cracks, and the thing that has possessed my friend grunts triumphantly. I howl in rage. Deep in the forest, the djinn laugh. I ignore them, drawing on the mask deep within, refusing to allow myself to get distracted. No human could hear the djinn, but the spirit within Afia stops and tilts its head, listening. I use her inattention to send a throwing knife straight at her face. The hilt hits her square in the forehead. Her eyes roll back, and she thuds to the dirt. For the moment, I push my concern for Afia aside and step over her prone body, scanning the area around me for more ghosts. And suddenly, I feel a flicker of magic within me. The little magic I received when vowing myself a soulcatcher responds to something greater. Thin tendrils of darkness coil like smoke out of the waiting place toward me. Martha. For a moment, Martha's magic fills me. The ghost that oozes out of Afia is no match for this power, and I wrap the magic around the spirit to bind it and then fling it back to the waiting place. I spot the last ghost 100 yards away, lurking inside the body of a young woman attacking her family. I whip the magic out like a shepherd's crook and hook the ghost. It howls in rage, but I yank it out of the girl's body and send it flying back to the forest. Skies, the power, the ease of it. It's like I was born to it. I want to crow. I am so happy. Finally, finally, the magic has come to me. Afia moans and I drop beside her. Already a goose egg rises on her head, but she's not seriously hurt, not like Gibran. I reach for her, thinking to carry her to her tribe, but the moment I do so, the power that suffused me dissipates.
What? No!
I grasp for it with my hands, but it leaves me, dark tendrils disappearing back into the forest. I feel strangely desolate, as if my own strength has left me. The only trace of the magic is a tug from Martha, that dark insistence that's always there when I leave the waiting place.
Banu al-Ma'atha?
Arborit appears behind me, her hand at her mouth when she sees Afia.
The Zaldara, her brother.
I'm sorry, Fakira, I say. It was my fault the ghosts escaped. Another tug at my gut from Martha. This one stops me in my tracks. It feels different from before. Not impatient, urgent. Djinn laughter fills my ears, and the sound is edged in vengeance and flame.
Do you smell anything, Elias Veturius? Smoke, perhaps?
What are they up to? The djinn cannot escape their imprisonment in the grove. That, at least, I can be sure of. The magic of the star has locked them there, and their only power is their voice. Voices can be ignored.
And voices can be used. Come home, Elias. See what awaits.
Home. Home. Shaver's cabin. My sanctuary. My safety.
Sleep in the cottage. They cannot hurt you there.
I fly to the trees without an explanation to Oberette. The second I'm through the border, I sense interlopers, many of them far to the north. It's the same presence I felt for weeks lurking round the edges of the forest. In the brief time that they are in the forest, I see them in my mind's eye, larger than ghouls or wights, but smaller than wraiths. Ifrits. The djinn must have warned them, for they flee the waiting place. Even if I windwalk, they are too far away. I will never catch them. Long before I reach the clearing, I know. Before I smell the smoke, see the dying flames. Before I walk past the spot Shaver died, and the place where I was named Soulcatcher, I know. Still, I do not believe until the glowing embers of Shaver's cabin are burning through my boots. The Ifrits did not just set it alight. They broke the beams and razed the garden. They destroyed it, and the magic it was made with. My sanctuary, my home, is gone, and I will never get it back. And all the while, the djinn laugh.
Chapter 22. The Bloodshrike. Grimar and his men attack the next night at sundown, just after Avitas and I return to Navium. Having destroyed much of the southwest quarter, they aim now for the southeast. The bombardment is swift and merciless, and by the time the sun has faded, the quarter is hotter than a pyre. Drums echo from all corners of the city, ordering evacuations. The ballistae on the watchtowers sing, and the commandant has troops amassing near the beaches in case of a land invasion. But other than that, we do not counter the Karkans. I know the commandant will have me blocked from entering the island. She'll have a phalanx of guards around it. The very thought of it enrages me. You could fight her. You could enlist the Black Guard and lay a trail of bloody havoc. But Skies know that if Grimar takes the city, Navium will need every soldier it can get. I make for the southeast quarter with Harper, Dex, Janus Atreus, and a handful of other blackguards at my back. The shouts and screams of men and women bring my attention back to what is before me. Utter devastation. High buildings have been reduced to rubble and ash, as terrified plebeians try desperately to escape the quarter. Many are injured, and though there are some soldiers giving the evacuees orders, no one appears to know where the hells the plebeians are supposed to go. Hope is stronger than fear. It is stronger than hate. The sentiment rings through my head. Then Livia's words. I am thankful every day for the plebeians. Their support of both the Emperor and myself is a comfort during this trying time. And Quinn's.
She cares about one thing. Power.
How can I take it away from her? A tenuous plan forms in my head. Dex, open the Blackguard barracks. Get out the word that the plebeians should take shelter there. Jens Aquila has a manor north of here. It's a half-hour walk at most. Order the caretaker to clear out the lower levels of the house and provide food, drink, and a place to sleep. We'll be using it as an infirmary.
Jens Atria has a house close to the Aquila Manor.
Dex looks to his uncle, who nods.
I'll give the order to have it opened, Janus says.
Take the men. I gesture to the other black guards. Get physicians to both manors. Find medical supplies from the outer districts
and make sure every single person, physician or patient, knows that they are there by order of the Bloodshrike. After Dex and Janice leave with the men, I turn to Harper. Get me information on the assets of every pater who was at the island the day we arrived, I say. Every ship, every last scrap of lace or drop of rum or whatever the hells they trade in. I want to know how those paters make their money, and get eyes in the homes of Admiral Argus and Vice Admiral Vesalius. Argus's wife was spotted at the dressmaker's spending obscene amounts of money 2 nights ago. I want to know why she wasn't in mourning with the rest of the family. While Dex immediately took to horse, Harper merely shifts on his saddle. What in the bleeding skies is wrong with him? Did you not hear me? Go!
You must have a guard with you at all times, Bloodshrike, Avitas says. Not because you are incapable, but because the Bloodshrike must show her strength. There is strength in numbers.
There is strength in winning, I say. To win, I need men I trust to carry out my orders. Avitas's jaw tenses, and he wheels his horse away. By midnight, the bombardment has stopped. The Blackguard barracks are full of those who have escaped the southeast quarter, and Manor Aquila and Manor Atria are bursting with the injured. As I walk among the ill at Manor Aquila, my body is drawn toward those suffering the most. The need to heal is overpowering. Dozens of songs fill my head at the sight of so much pain.
They're plebeians.
Dex, who has rejoined me, shakes his head. Every last one. Bloodshrike. A white-smocked man appears, his sharp-featured face paling at the sight of me.
I am Lieutenant Silvius. Sit, please.
I'm fine. The winter in my voice has him standing taller.
Tell me what you require, Lieutenant.
Medicines, teas, bandages, spirits, Silvius says. And more hands.
Dex, I say. Help the lieutenant. I'll deal with them. I nod to an angry crowd gathering outside the infirmary. When I emerge, the crowd goes silent, their respect for the Bloodshrike so deeply ingrained that even in the face of their suffering, they hold their tongues. All but one woman, who shoves through until she's inches from my face.
My baby boy is in there, she whispers. I don't know if he's alive, if he's hurting or...
Your families are being cared for, I say, but you must let the physicians work.
Why aren't we fighting back?
An orc soldier limps forward, uniform ripped, forehead leaking blood.
My entire family, they...
He shakes his head.
Why aren't we fighting?
I don't know, I say. But we will stop the barbarians. They won't set foot on Navium's shores. I vow it, by blood and by bone. The tenor of the crowd shifts. A weight has been lifted. As the throng dissipates, I feel the tug of my healing again. Hope is stronger than fear. What if I was able to give these people a greater measure of hope? A quick glance tells me that Lieutenant Silvius is deep in conversation with Dex. I slip across the back courtyard to the children's wing. The nurse nods a greeting, but leaves me be. While her attention is elsewhere, I cross the room and drop beside a dark-haired child. His eyelashes curl the way mine never will, his cheeks round and ashen. I take his small, cold hand in mine and search out his song. Sails like birds on the sea, the laugh of his father, watching for dolphins on the water. It is pure, a shaft of sunlight falling onto a glittering ocean. I do not hum his song aloud. Instead, I sing it in my head, as I did long ago for Cook. One bar, two, three, until weakness fills me. When I open my eyes, his face has lost its unnatural grey hue, and I move on. With each child, I do just enough to ease their pain and bring them back from the edge. My body grows fatigued, but there are dozens of injured left.
One by one I sing them well, until I can hardly walk. I need to leave. I need to rest. But then a whimper breaks the quiet. A little boy in the back of the infirmary. Dark-haired and grey-eyed. The wound on his chest weeps into his bandage. I stumble the few steps to his bed. He is awake.
I'm afraid, he whispers. The pain will soon be gone. No, he says. Of them.
It takes me a moment to understand. The Karkans.
They'll come back. They'll kill us.
I look around. A wooden tray sits nearby, thick enough to prove my point.
See, lad, if I open my hand and try to break this wood,
I smack the tray. Nothing happens. But if I make a fist, I punch through the wood easily, startling the nurse. We are marshals, child. We are the fist. Our enemies are the wood. And we shall break them. After I find his song and he falls into slumber, I head for the door. When I emerge into the courtyard, I'm stunned to see that dawn is only an hour or two away. The infirmary is much quieter now. On the other side of the yard, Dex stands with Silvius, his head bent thoughtfully, as the physician speaks. Remembering Harper's comment about strength in numbers, and concerned at the depth of my fatigue, I almost call out to my friend. But I stop myself. There is a charge in the air between Dex and Silvius that makes me smile. The first time I've felt anything other than rage or exhaustion all day. I head for the courtyard gate without Dex. It's a short enough walk to the barracks. My senses are dulled as I walk, my legs growing weaker. A platoon of soldiers patrols nearby, saluting when I pass, and I am barely able to acknowledge them. I wish then that I'd asked Dex to accompany me. I hope to the skies there's no Karkan assault. Right now, I couldn't fight off a fly. Exhausted as I am, the part of me that raged and screamed at my own impotence in the face of Grimmar's attacks has quieted. I will sleep tonight. Maybe I'll even dream. A step behind me. Dex? No. The street is empty. I squint, trying to see into the darkness. A furtive scrape ahead of me this time, someone trying to remain unobserved. My senses prickle. I didn't spend a decade and a half at Blackcliff, only to get accosted by some idiot a few blocks from my own barracks. I draw my sim and summon my shrike's voice.
You'd be a fool to try it, I say, but by all means, entertain me.
When the first dart comes flying out of the dark, I whip it out of the air by force of habit. I spent hundreds of hours deflecting missiles as a yearling. A knife follows the dart.
Show yourself, I snarl.
A shadow moves to my right, and I fling a throwing knife at it. The figure thuds to the ground, only a dozen yards from me, clutching at his neck. I make for him, aiming to unhood him. Filthy, traitorous coward. But my legs will not move. Pain explodes along my side, sudden and white hot. I look down. There's blood everywhere. From the infirmary? No. It's my blood. Walk, Shrike. Move. Get out of here. But I cannot. I have no strength at all. I drop to my knees, able to do nothing more than watch as my life drains out of me.
Chapter 23 Liar. When Musa and I set out from Edessa, the sun blazes high, burning away the morning mist that has rolled in off the sea. But we do not clear the walls until early evening, as the guards are carefully watching all who leave as well as all who enter. Musa's disguise, that of an old man with a piebald donkey, is frighteningly effective, and the guards don't look at him twice. Still, he waits until it is completely dark before bagging his Tattersall cloak and raggedy wig. In a copse of trees, he pulls a Sarek steel Sims from a high pile of sticks on the donkey's back and sends the creature off with a slap to the rump.
My sources tell me Tribe Sulud left late last night, which means we'll find their camp in one of the coastal villages to the south,
Musa says. I nod a response, peering over my shoulder. The shadows of the night billow and contract. Though summer is in full bloom, I shiver and move swiftly across the marshy grasses.
Will you stop looking back like that?
Musa says, immune as ever to my magic.
You're making me nervous.
I just wish we could go faster, I say. I feel strange, like there's something back there. The Nightbringer disappeared so swiftly last night that I questioned whether he was even in Edessa. But since then, I haven't been able to shake the sense that something watches me.
I have mounts hidden down the road. Once we get to them, we can move more quickly.
Musa laughs at my obvious impatience.
What? You don't want to pass the time in conversation with me? He says. I'm hurt.
I just want to get the Kahani, I mumble, though this is not the only reason I chafe at the delay. Musa regards me thoughtfully, and I lengthen my stride. He doesn't believe that I should offer to supply weapons to the tribes, even if it means gaining information on the Nightbringer. Not when those weapons might be used to kill innocent martial civilians in the south. But he doesn't stop me, though he easily could with that eerie magic of his. Instead, he accompanies me, his distaste palpable. His disappointment gnaws at me. It is part of the reason I do not speak to him. I do not want his judgment. But there's more to my silence. Speaking to him would mean learning about him, understanding him, maybe befriending him. I know what it is to travel with someone, to break bread and laugh, and grow close to them. And though perhaps it's foolish, that frightens me, because I also know the pain of losing friends, family, mother, father, Liss, Nan, Pop, Izzy, Elias. Too many lost. Too much pain. I shake off my invisibility. It's not as if you'll actually answer any of my questions. Anyway, I do want to talk to you. It's just... Dizziness sweeps over me. I recognize the feeling. No, not now. Not when I need to get to the Kahani. Though inside, I scream with frustration. I cannot stop the vision. The dank room, the shape of a woman. Her hair is light. Her face is in shadow. And that voice again, so familiar.
A star, she came into my home and lit it bright with glory. Her laughter light. A gilded song, a rain cloud, sparrows, story.
I want to get closer. I want to see the face. I know the voice. I have heard it before. I search my memories. Who is she? A soft crack sounds. The singing stops.
Oi! I wake to Musa smacking my face and I shove him away.
What the hell's Musa?
You're the one who collapsed like some sort of swooning theater heroine, he says crossly. I've been trying to wake you for an hour. Does that happen every time you use your invisibility? Rather inconvenient.
Just the past few times. I get to my feet. My head aches, but I cannot tell if it is from falling or from Musa's slap. It never used to happen, I say. And the blackouts are getting longer.
The more you use the magic, the more it takes from you. At least that's what I've seen.
Musa offers me his canteen and shivvies me forward. This time, he peers over his shoulder. What? I say. Did you see something back there?
It's after dark. Highwaymen aren't unheard of this far from the city. Best if we reach the horses. You were complaining that I never answer questions. Ask, and I'll try not to disappoint you.
I know he's distracting me, but my curiosity is piqued. I have not spoken with anyone about my magic. I wanted to talk to Darin, but didn't want to burden him. The only one who might understand is the Bloodshrike, with her powers of healing.
I scowl at the thought of having a discussion with her about it.
How does your magic take from you?
Musa is quiet for a long time as we walk, the night growing deeper around us. The stars are a streak of silver light above, illuminating the road almost as well as a full moon.
The magic makes me seek control when there is none to be found, he says. It is the magic of manipulation, of speaking, of getting lesser creatures to bend to my will. It's why I was so good with my father's bees. But when I rely too much on it, it makes me into my worst self, a tyrant.
These creatures you can manipulate, I say. Do they include ghouls?
I'd not sully my mind by communicating with those little brutes.
A chitter comes from somewhere near Moose's feet, and I spot a flash of iridescence, like torchlight on water. It disappears, and Musa lifts his hands, which I could have sworn were empty a moment ago. Now he holds a scroll.
For you, he says.
I snatch the scroll from him, reading through it quickly before dropping my arm in disgust. This doesn't tell me anything.
It tells you that the blood shrike was injured.
He looks down at the parchment.
And that the paters have turned against her. Her survival is quite miraculous. Interesting. I wonder.
I don't care about the bleeding blood shrike or martial politics, I hiss. I need to know whom else the Nightbringer is spending his time with.
You sound like an ex-lover.
Musa lifts his eyebrows, and I realize he must know about me and Keenan, about what happened between us. Embarrassment floods me. I wish now that I hadn't opened up to him.
Ah, Laya Apan.
He uses the mariner honorific for little sister and jostles me with an arm.
We've all made mistakes in love. Me most of all.
Love, I sigh. Love is joy coupled with misery, elation bound to despair. It is a fire that beckons me gently and then burns when I get too close. I hate love. I yearn for it, and it drives me mad. In any case, it is not something I want to discuss with anyone, least of all Musa. Among the paters, I say, is there anyone with whom the Nightbringer has spent more time? Another crooning chitter.
My friend here says he will find out.
I catch a glimpse of shimmering iridescent wings and shiver with sudden knowledge. Musa, I whisper, is that a bleeding white? Whites are fey, like wraiths, but smaller, swifter, and craftier. Stories say they are tricksters who enjoy luring humans to their deaths.
My little spies, swift as the wind, obsessed with candied almonds, which you might have noticed when you poked around my room.
He gives me an arch look, and I flush, embarrassed.
And they're actually very sweet creatures, once you get to know them.
Whites, I raise my eyebrows. A sweet?
I wouldn't cross one, no. But they're very loyal. More loyal than most humans, anyway.
And strangely, it is that comment, delivered almost defensively, that finally makes me less suspicious of Musa. I do not trust him, not yet. But I realize I like him. I did not know how much I missed having someone to talk to. With Darin, the simplest conversation sometimes feels like dancing on butterflies' wings. What of my end of the bargain? I ask. You're spreading my story and making me out to be some sort of hero.
Leader, actually.
I knew a deal with him wouldn't be as simple as recruiting resistance fighters. You want me to lead the resistance?
If I told you that in the prison cell, you'd have rejected my offer.
Because I have no wish to lead anyone. Look at what happened to my mother. To Mazen. Musa's calm only incenses me further. Why don't you do it yourself? Why me?
I'm a scholar of Adisa. Musa says, my family has lived here for more than 200 years. The refugees don't need me to speak for them. They need someone who understands their pain to plead their case before King Ermond.
I glance at him, alarmed. Is this what you meant when you said you wanted to work with the king? Have you forgotten that he wants to imprison Darren and me? And you?
That's Nicola's doing.
Musa shrugs off my protests.
I doubt she told her father she had you and Darren in her clutches.
He's old,
ailing. She's used his weakness to push the scholars out of Edessa and into the camps, to strip land and titles from Edessan scholars. But the princess doesn't rule yet. While the king lives, there's hope that he'll listen to reason, especially from the daughter of the lioness, who he considered a friend.
He catches sight of my face in the dark and chuckles.
Don't look so worried, he says. You won't go in unprepared. We'll have one chance to plead our case before the king. The future of our people depends on how successful we are. We need support from the refugees and Edessan scholars before then. It's why I've had you meet with so many of my friends. If we have enough scholars at our backs, King Ermond will have to listen to us.
But gathering so many will take time. Time I do not have. Guilt stabs through me. Musa has spent weeks building me up. But the moment I learn how to stop the Nightbringer, I'll have to depart Edessa. And where does that leave him? Alive. To fight, I tell myself firmly. Instead of dead in a gin-fueled apocalypse. Shortly after we reach the horses, a summer storm rolls in from the ocean, drenching us in minutes. Still wary, I insist that we ride through the night. Musa's whites report Tribe Salud's location, and we finally draw to a halt outside a coastal village, just as the fishing trawlers drift out to sea. The sodden fields around the village are thick with farmhands harvesting summer crops. Tribe Salud's wagons sit near the docks, a stone's throw from the village's only inn, where Musa takes rooms. I hope the Kahani knows something about the Nightbringer. The approach of the grain moon, 7 weeks away, looms over me like an executioner's axe. Please. I cast my wish to the stars, hoping the universe is listening. Please let me learn something useful. Musa insists we clean up. She won't let us in her wagon if we smell of horse and sweat. By the time we emerge from the inn, a group of tribesmen awaits us. They greet Musa as an old friend and me with a formal politeness. Without fanfare, we are led to the largest of the wagons, painted with purple fish and yellow flowers, white herons and crystalline rivers. Pendants of tarnished silver hang from the wagon's back, and when the door swings open, they jangle merrily. The Kehani wears a simple robe, instead of the finery of the other night, but her bearing is no less noble. The bracelets on her arms jingle, hiding the heavy, faded tattoos on her arms.
Musa of Edessa, she greets him. Still getting yourself into trouble you can't get out of.
Always, Kehani.
Ah, she watches him shrewdly. So you have finally seen her for what she is.
An old pain flashes in Musa's eyes, and I know that they are not speaking of me.
I have hope for her yet. Do not wait for her, child. Sometimes those we love are lost to us, as surely as if death himself had claimed them. All we can do is mourn the divergence of their path. If you try to walk it, you too will fall into darkness.
Musa opens his mouth as if to respond, but the Kehani turns to me.
You bring questions, Liar of Sarah. Do you bring payment?
I have Seric steel weapons, I say. 6 blades, freshly forged. The Kehani sniffs and summons one of her kinsmen. Musa catches my eye, and though he says nothing, I find myself fidgeting. I think of what Darin said.
You have your own strength. It doesn't have to be the same as the lioness's.
Wait, I place my hands on the weapons, just as the Kehani is handing them to the tribesmen. Please, I say,
Use them in defense. Use them to fight the soldiers. But not those who are innocent. Please.
The tribesman looks at the Kehani questioningly. She murmurs something to him in Sadhis, and he steps out.
Liar of Sarah, you would tell a tribeswoman how to defend herself?
No, I twine my fingers together. I would ask that these blades, which are a gift, not be used to shed the blood of innocents.
Humph, the Kehani says. Then she leans over to the front of her wagon and offers me a small wooden bowl of salt. I breathe a sigh of relief and put a pinch on my tongue, the custom Afya taught me. We are under her tribe's protection now. None who belong to it may harm us.
Your gift is accepted, Liar of Sarah. How may I aid you?
I heard you spinning the old tales in Edessa. Can you tell me of the djinn? Do they have any weaknesses? Is there a way to kill them, I nearly say. But the word is so cold. Hurt them?
During the Fae Scholar War, your ancestors murdered the djinn with steel and salt and summer rain fresh from the heavens. But you asked the wrong question, Liar of Sarah. I know of you. I know you do not seek to destroy the djinn. You seek to destroy the Nightbringer, and he is something else altogether.
Can it be done? Can he be killed?
The Kehani leans back in a pile of soft pillows and considers. The slide of her fingers against the wagon's lacquered wood sounds like sand hissing through an hourglass.
He is the first of his kind, she says. Rain will turn to steam on his skin, and steel to molten metal. As for salt, he will simply laugh to see it used against him, for he has inured himself to its effects. No, the Nightbringer cannot be killed, not by a human, anyway, but he can be stopped.
How?
Rain thuds on the wooden roof of the wagon, and I'm reminded suddenly of the drums of the Empire, the way their tattoo echoed down into my bones, leaving me jittery.
Come back tonight, the Kehani says, when the moon is high, and I will tell you.
Musa sighs.
Kehani, with respect, tonight.
I shake my head.
But our stories are not bones left on the road for any hungry animal that happens along.
The Kehani's voice rises and I flinch back.
Our stories have purpose, souls. Our stories breathe. Liar of Sarah. The stories we tell have power, of course, but the stories that go untold have just as much power, if not more. I will sing you such a story that was long untold. The story of a name and its meaning, of how that name matters more than any other single word in existence. But I must prepare myself. For such stories are dragons drawn from a deep well in a dark place. Does one summon a dragon? No. One may only invite it and hope it emerges. So, tonight.
The Kehani refuses to say anything more, and soon Musa and I retreat to the inn, exhausted. He disappears into his room with a half-hearted wave. The tribeswoman said the Nightbringer can be stopped. Will she tell me how? I shiver in anticipation. What sort of story will she sing tonight? A story that was long untold? The story of a name and its meaning? I open the door to my room, still wondering. But at the threshold, I freeze. Because there is someone inside.
Chapter 24. Elias. Without the cottage to protect me, my mind is vulnerable to the djinn. But though I try to stay awake, I am, in the end, only human. Since becoming Soulcatcher, I have not dreamed. I only realize it now, when I open my eyes and find myself in a dark alley on an empty street. A flag flaps in the wind, black with crossed hammers. Marcus's sigil. I taste salt in the summer air, overlaid by something bitter. Blood, smoke, burnt stone. Whispers ride the air, and I recognize the sibilant tones of the djinn. Is this one of their illusions? Is it real? A whimper breaks the silence. A hooded figure slumps on the ground behind me. I watch for a moment before moving toward the figure. I'm wary as a pale hand emerges from a cloak, clenched tightly around a blade. But when I see the face beneath the hood, my caution disappears. It's the Bloodshrike. Blood blooms from her hunched body, staining the cobblestones around her, merciless and inexorable.
I'm sorry,
the Bloodshrike whispers when she sees me.
For what I did to Mamie, the Empire.
She coughs, and I crouch beside her, a hand on her back. She feels warm, alive. Who did this to you? Some part of me knows this is a dream, but that part fades and I'm simply in it, living it as if it's real. The Shrike's face is drawn and white, her teeth chattering though the night is clear and warm. When I run my hands over her arms, trying to find her injury, she shudders, lifting back her cloak to show a wound in her belly. It looks bad. Very bad. It's a dream. Just a dream. Still, fear stabs through me. I was angry at her when I last met her, but seeing her like this transfers my rage to whoever did this to her. Plans fall into place. Where is the nearest infirmary? Get her there. No, the barracks. Which barracks? But I can't do any of that. But this is a dream.
Are you here to welcome me to, what did she call it? The waiting place?
You're not dead, I say, and you're not going to die. Do you hear me? A powerful memory hits me. The first trial, Marcus attacking her, the Shrike's too light body against mine as I carried her down the mountain. You're going to live. You're going to find whoever did this to you. You're going to make them pay. Get up. Get to safety. Urgency grips me. I must say these words to her. I feel that knowledge in my bones. Her pupils dilate. Her body straightens. You are Bloodshrike of the Empire, I say, and you are meant to survive. Get up! When she finds my eyes, her own are glassy. I catch my breath, for they are so real. The shape, the emotions, the color of them, like the violet heart of a quiet sea. The way her face changes beneath her mask, the stiffness of her jaw as she grits her teeth. But then she fades, as does the city. Silence descends. Darkness. When I open my eyes again, I expect to be back in the waiting place. But this time, I'm in a room I've never seen. The smooth wood floor is swept clean and strewn with mirrored cushions. There is a faint, familiar fragrance in the air, and my heart thuds faster, my body recognizing the scent before my mind does. The door opens and Lyra enters. Her dark hair has fallen loose from her braid, and she chews on her lip as she always does when she's deep in thought. The faint glow of a torch seeps in from the hallway behind her, lighting her face a soft gold brown. Purple half-moons shadow her eyes. The ocean thunders distantly, the creak of fishing boats a strange counter-melody to that roar. I step toward her, gripped by a soul-deep longing for her to be real. I want to hear her speak my name. I want to dip my hands into the cool shade of her hair, to take solace in her gaze. She freezes when she sees me, her mouth falling into an O.
You're here. How?
It's a dream, I say. I'm in the waiting place. I fell asleep.
A dream?
She shakes her head.
No, Elias. You're real. I was just downstairs talking to Musa.
Who Who the bleeding hells is Musa?
Jealous?
She laughs, and immediately I want to hear her laugh again.
Now I know this isn't a dream. Dream Elias would know that he never needs to be jealous.
I'm not, I consider. Never mind, I am jealous. Tell me he's old, at least, or grouchy, or maybe a bit stupid.
He's young and handsome and smart.
I snort. He's probably rubbish in Lias smacks me on the arm. Battle, I say quickly.
I was going to say battle. He doesn't hold a candle to you.
Lias shakes her head.
I must be more exhausted than I thought, but I could have sworn I was awake. I feel awake. Did you windwalk here? How could you if you were sleeping?
I wish it weren't a dream, I say. I do, but it has to be. Otherwise I couldn't. I reach out my hand, and for a moment it hovers near hers. I take it, for once not dreading the interference of the ghosts, and she squeezes. Her palm fits perfectly against mine, and I lift her hand and brush my lips across her fingers. I couldn't do this, I speak softly. The ghosts, the waiting place, they wouldn't let me.
Then tell me, Dream Elias, she murmurs. What did you say to me? The night you left me in the tribal desert, the night you left me the note, what did you say?
I said, I shake my head. Mamie Reeler used to say that dreams are the bits of ourselves we can't face in the day, coming to visit at night. If I had never left Lyra that night, if Keenan had never gotten the chance to betray her, if I'd not been caught by the warden, if I'd never vowed to stay in the waiting place, then I wouldn't be stuck there for eternity. This dream version of Lyra questions me because I question myself. Part of me knows I should pay attention to those questions, that they are a weakness I should crush. But most of me just wants to revel in the fact that I am seeing Lyra, and I wasn't sure I ever would again.
I miss you.
She pushes back a curl, and I can't take my eyes off the skin of her wrist, disappearing into a bell-shaped sleeve, or the hollow in her neck, or the shape of her legs, long and perfectly curved in riding breeches.
It's a dream, Elias,
I remind myself sternly, trying to ignore how badly I want to feel those legs wrapped around me.
Of course her legs look incredible and perfect, and I wish we could.
When she puts her hand to my face, I savor the whirls in her fingertips, the gentle scrape of her nails. I look down into her eyes, golden and endless and full of all the desire I feel. I don't want this to disappear. I don't want to wake up to ghosts howling and djinn plotting. I unravel her braid. She takes my other hand and puts it on her hip, and I trace the curve with a light touch that makes her close her eyes.
Why is it like this? She asks. Why must we be apart? I miss what we should have been, Elias. Is that possible?
Her hand drops to my chest, to the shredded remains of my shirt, torn in the battle with the ghosts.
What the skies happened to you?
She looks me over with a healer's concern.
And why do you smell like smoke?
Self-examination again. Her questions are my own subconscious, holding me accountable for my mistakes. If Fritz burned down Shavers, my house, part of a djinn trick to torment me.
No,
she pales.
Why? The Nightbringer?
Perhaps. He must have sent the Ifrits, and the djinn in the grove told them when it was safe to enter the forest. I shake my head.
I'm nothing like Shaver, Lyra. I'm not getting the ghosts through fast enough. Three of them escaped and did terrible things. I can't control the djinn, and I can't stop the ghosts suffering. It is my fault,
Lyra slumps.
If I hadn't trusted him, given him the armlet, he wouldn't have gone after her. Shaver should never have died.
It's such a liar thing to say that I stare at her, perplexed. This is a dream, is it not? And the Bloodshrike, I hope that was a dream. I expect Lyra to say something, I would think. Instead, she continues to berate herself.
I ask myself every day why I did not see him for what he was.
No. I brush away the tears from her black eyelashes. Don't blame yourself. My voice is low, scratchy. Why have I forgotten how to talk? Please, it's not. She lifts her face, and my desire for her pools low and sudden. I can't stop myself from pulling her body to mine. She gasps softly and rises. Her lips against mine are urgent. She doesn't know when she'll kiss me again. The same frantic need courses through me. My mind shouts at me that this is too real. But no ghosts trouble us. I want her, she wants me, and we have wanted each other for so long. She pulls away from the kiss, and I'm certain I will wake up, that this sky's given time with her, devoid of ghosts railing at us, or Martha pulling at me, is about to end. But she only shoves away the remnants of my shirt, before running her nails gently across my skin, sighing with pleasure, or want, or both. I can't bear her lips away from mine, so I dip down again. But on my way, I'm distracted by her shoulder. I find myself kissing it, then nipping at her neck, a primal part of me deeply satisfied by the moan I elicit from her, by the way her body relaxes into mine. As her breath heaves, more ragged with every kiss on her throat, I feel her twine her leg around mine. Yes. And I drop my hands to lift her up. The bed is too far, but there's a wall, and when I pin her against it, she rakes her hand across my back, murmuring, "Yes, Elias, yes," until I am shaking with need. "The things," I whisper in her ear, "that I want to do to you. Tell me." Her tongue flicks across my ear, and I forget to breathe. "Show me."